Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Today, I'm joined by Rosie Viva, model, presenter, and mental health activist. Rosie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
It's so nice to be here back in the studio in London, face to face. We were just talking about, you know, how you can obviously record anywhere now, anytime, anywhere, but I don't think anything for me is as good as being in the studio together.
Yeah, I think you give a different answer as well when you're in person, because you can't hide from the truth because it would just show on your face.
Yeah. Well, let's dive in. I've got so many things that I want to talk to you about today. And I think, you know, we hear this mental health activist, and I'm going to, I suppose, ask you about, you know, your journey and why you want to share what you do online and with the world, because I think it's incredibly courageous to do that. And I think over the last decade, there's been an increase in awareness of mental health disorders as well as neurodiversity, but there's a lot of generalization. And I definitely think I see that there's a lot of generalized statements, a lot of stereotyping. So I suppose, what misconceptions do you think that people often have about neurodiversity, and how could we dispel them?
I think the biggest misconception is that, or for me, what I found with something like bipolar or schizophrenia, is that it's not someone you know. It's not someone who functions in so many ways similar to you. So I think the main thing which held me back from getting my bipolar diagnosis was the fact that anyone who I knew thought bipolar was this thing which maybe someone old might have, someone they would never meet, someone from a different background, someone who didn't also struggle with anxiety and depression or find social situations awkward or any sort of other symptom around mental illness, which led them to have a sort of things in common with their friends to then give them a bipolar diagnosis. I think my friends just didn't put me in that box because so much of what I was saying or what I was talking about was similar to their own experience in mental health. Mm. So I guess looking at that now, it's such a driving factor for me talking about this publicly, because those small differences can give you such a different diagnosis and really be the breakthrough for getting that. Mm. So I guess, yeah, the best way to dispel it is open up conversation and really hear your friend's symptoms a little clearer and not just think, oh, okay, they're depressed, but maybe question, well, how does your depression feel? What sort of thoughts are you receiving? And I think, yeah, by giving honest answers and making those conversations with friends, you sort of start to realise people's small differences can make a big difference in dispelling the sort of stigmas.
Yeah. And how can people, I suppose, maybe even start to understand that about themselves? Because I think often what we do is we like downplay things, don't we? So if somebody's mm-hmm. struggling for a long time, they might think, oh, well, you know, I'm just tired, or, you know, this is just how I am. Or they might not actually think that. You know, it's almost like people think, oh, it's not that bad, so I'll just keep going and I'll just, you know, carry on and kind of keep pushing through. Or maybe I just need to get an early night, or, you know, do some more yoga, or, you know, take the supplement. And actually, how can people start to understand that when their symptoms maybe, you know, they need to go and speak to a professional and find out and get a diagnosis?
I do find, I mean, like you just said, where it's that thing of maybe I'm just too tired, or putting it on yourself. I actually recently, 4 years after my diagnosis, just a couple of weeks ago, tried to lower my medication. And I think it was such a part of me which was still, even though I speak publicly about this, even though I encourage people to get help, there was such a big part of me thinking, oh, maybe underneath it all, you know, I can just get through this without medication. And my ego kicked in. And actually, I think what I need to come back to and take my own advice on quite often is that thing of, like, it's so good to accept help every day. And it's so good to sort of keep those conversations going with like-minded people, so you treat yourself how you would treat them.
So can you take us back then and maybe share a little bit about that journey and how you got your diagnosis?
So I always sort of start when I talk about my diagnosis with the year 2018, just because when I was growing up, I had really sort of serious mental health issues, but I didn't speak about it. And I was so certain in my mind that there was a cause in my life at the time. So in sixth form, I was so unhappy, but because I was really not someone very suited to school, I always blamed it on that. And when it did end and I was on holiday or I finished school in sixth form, my mood did lift. So I sort of never put it down to something different than just my situation and being young and sort of adapting. And then never got in the way of work, even though I was sort of, there was a year with my job where I was living in Paris and I was very lonely and I slipped back into depression. But because I knew Paris had made me lonely again, I sort of found another thing in my life. Whereas in 2018, I was in such a brilliant place, like with my career, was in a really loving relationship, earning really well, so taking holidays often, exercising, eating well, like on paper, I just felt so in control and so excited for where I was. But I started getting really bad physical anxiety. So I was sort of having vertigo, where I was just feeling like the ground was dropping and I'd sort of freak out. And there was one day at work where there was building works in ASOS, where I was working really often at the time. And I remember freaking out and saying, oh my gosh, did anyone feel that? I think, you know, I don't think this is safe. And no one in the room knew what I was talking about. And I'd started having these sort of physical reactions to my anxiety. So I started seeing a doctor when I was convinced I had like heart issues or maybe an ear infection. And then the sort of nature of the panic attack started really being equally mental as physical. And my fear of being outside of my house in case it happened led to this sort of mixed period of physical and mental symptoms starting really sort of fast paced. And then there was one day where my panic attack was so bad that I called an ambulance and I went to a hospital just near Paddington. And for the first time, a doctor said, you know, I can do checks if you want. We can get another heart scan, but I can see in your records the last month you've been having all these physical checks and nothing's wrong. Do you think it could be anxiety? So I sort of, I don't know if anyone listening or whether you've had this, but I think that was the first time where I thought, okay, when people talk about struggling with their mental health, this is what they mean. I'd perhaps had quite a sheltered experience with it before, where it had never got in the way of my work or like seeing friends or family. So I just sort of managed, whereas this was like, I need to be off work. There's no way I can go in tomorrow. And then I guess it was just that thing of the first step for a lot of GPs in maybe some ways and maybe some ways missing some symptoms, but I went on antidepressants. And for people with bipolar, antidepressants can trigger their first episode because you're sort of pushing someone's mood up for someone who really needs a stabilizer instead of an upper.
So sorry, so interrupt, but how old were you at the time when you were having this experience?
I was 21 into 22, so.
Because, yeah, it must, firstly, it must have been so difficult, I think, what you're describing, you know, having that, just so scary to kind of think, okay, these physical sensations as you're describing and thinking, is there something wrong with my heart? Is there something wrong inside my body? And it's interesting, isn't it, how when we have, I think, you know, when we have ill mental health or when we have anxiety or a period of low mood or depression or even a trauma, I think that when it's to do with our emotion, so often we look for the physical, there must be a cause, there must be a reason, you know, there must be a, well, if I go to, like you said, an ear infection or a chest infection, or if I go to the doctor and they tell me, oh, you're low in, I don't know, iron, you're going to go, ah, okay, that's it. That's the reason. And I think often that's what we look for. Even, you know, I think about my own experience, if I, when I've done talking therapy before and kind of talked about previous trauma, it's almost like, then the way your body responds, and you might feel exhausted, you might feel, you might have a headache, you might have real physical symptoms of the body, but we don't necessarily connect them to our mental health. And as much as we know that our minds and body are connected, do you know what I mean?
By there's like still thinking, a disconnect.
Disconnect and thinking, oh, why do I have this physical symptom? It's nothing to do with that, it's something else. And yeah, what was the, I guess looping back then, what would you say your experience was like going to those healthcare professionals? So when you went and said, I think there's something wrong with me, or can I have this test, or can I have this scan? Like, do you feel like they were open to that? Did you feel supported through that system? What was that like?
I think before I put so much hope in the doctors that year, and I also did therapy once a week. And something just wasn't adding up. It just, the sort of nature of my depression felt so different to what I'd read about depression being. I wasn't just like low mood and unable to exercise. I was having these days of elation where I would say sweeping statements like, I'm cured and I'm going back to work and this has all just been the fault of this. Or, and then it sort of, yeah, the depression was also very full of paranoia and delusion. And that was where, with the doctors, I started feeling this frustration that I was maybe not being taken seriously enough, which looking back was maybe quite valid because even my therapist didn't spot the bipolar when I've gone on to have a very textbook case. But after I was diagnosed, so there was, my boyfriend broke up with me at the time towards the end of 2018, and it pushed me into my first psychotic episode, which lasted for 3 months. And when that happened, from then on, I just, the way I speak about my treatment in the NHS is so positive, because as soon as I got that diagnosis, everyone around me knew what we were dealing with and how to treat it. And I was so lucky with the care I got, particularly because I was in a London borough. So as soon as I came out of hospital, the sort of 3 years support which you're given for having a psychotic episode was just incredible. And they would have extended it to 5 years if I needed it. Like, I didn't feel I was being rushed out the system at all. So even though I had a bit of a bad experience before my diagnosis, I think that was just being in the wrong box. And usually I say, you know, it's not good to put people in a box, but I think for bipolar, I felt such a sense of relief when I was being treated for something with a different set of medication, with a different timeline, with a lot more focus on that balance rather than what I still struggle with, is where it's that thing of I'm going to get better, I'm going to be happy. Right. Whereas there's something really grounding about a bipolar diagnosis because you have to let that go. Okay. And there's such a refresh, actually, I found. Like, the last few years, you're just never aiming for perfection. It's just always just day by day. And overall, I don't think I've ever been, ironically, as happy as since I've been diagnosed, because it's just a new way to think about life, I guess.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. As you said, when you're seeking for an answer or a resolution or a solve or something, as you said, to kind of make this better so that then, okay, I'm better now, I'm happy now, everything's great. I can, yeah, it definitely makes sense that you would now feel as though, oh, okay, this is something that I'm going to manage and something that I'm going to live with. And just like everybody who has a physical health condition, you have to take medication, you have to monitor the symptoms, you have to see a professional. It's exactly the same, but it's not always viewed in that way. So last question I suppose on the diagnosis part, I feel like, and I don't want to kind of, you know, generalize as I've just said that, but I feel like a lot of people are reading a lot online, and the literacy around neurodiversity is becoming more frequent and available, and that's a good thing because, like you said, we want people to know about this. However, I feel like a lot of people kind of make sweeping statements about themselves and kind of like diagnosing themselves. So they might have never had a diagnosis, but they might say, oh, you know, I have ADHD, or I have, you know, an anxiety disorder, or I have bipolar, or kind of not in like a jokey way, but just in that kind of, you know, oh, well, I know that I do. So how important is it, I suppose, for someone, if they do think that, for them to get a diagnosis? And how, I suppose, yeah, cautious should we be about self-diagnosing and kind of throwing these terms around like as if it's just saying, oh, I've got a cold, you know?
Yeah, I think overdiagnosis is just such a thing, like you said, not even in a sort of official way, but with people online maybe saying, oh, I've got bipolar, I've got ADHD. But I think the main thing is it's so good to see a professional, because from my first understanding of bipolar to now, it is so different. I can't even explain. I thought bipolar was just going to be mood swings, but I didn't realise that those could be episodes of 6 months. I didn't realise that some days I would rapid cycle and have 15. I also didn't realise the sort of parts of the way I deal with things and my mind is going to be a bit different just because of experiencing those extremes in emotions. And I think it can be quite dangerous to have the wrong diagnosis or over-diagnose yourself with something maybe you're not struggling with just because of that fear of missing what you're actually going through. And there's so much out there which I didn't really know was a thing. Like, I'm only aware now that there's three different types of bipolar, and type 2 and type 1 have such different nature. Whereas when I started looking, it was just like, okay, I found this out. And then luckily I was around doctors to explain a bit more. But yes, I would say with that sort of overdiagnosis, it's just before you jump to conclusions, I always say, like, doctors have their job because of how much they know and how many years they've sort of looked into these things. So just coming from their judgment is probably always better.
Yeah. And you mentioned then that you had an idea of what you thought bipolar was, so maybe mood swings. And I think listeners of the show might even have an idea of, oh, I think I know what bipolar is. But in your experience, how would you describe how bipolar has shaped your life so far and your experiences today?
It's a bit of a weird one, just because I've written a diary since I was 11, and looking back at my diaries from about the age of 15, it's very obvious that I started having hypomania quite young and feeling so elated and not sleeping and feeling high on life. And I always like struggled with other people's energy when they were low in those states, because I just couldn't understand what there was to complain about. I just thought everything was perfect. My personal version is sort of comorbid with other things, and then also very sort of, each time it's very individual to the person. So in my experience, those mood swings are the most prevalent, but that's me on medication. Whereas off medication, my bipolar, being type 1, is very extreme. So I experience psychosis and I experience delusion on the lower end. But yeah, on a day-to-day basis, it's a swing, not just in mood, but also in energy levels. So I deal with fatigue a lot, and I deal with hypomania, where I have so much energy that I can't sleep and I feel very high and sort of thoughtful and my mind opens up. I see colours differently. Like I smell things very strongly. And I think the main one, which I still find quite interesting, is that when I'm high, I sort of feel people's energy in a different way. And you're just, you see from those psychotic months, life in such a detail I've never really even known was there. And when I have highs, I sort of tap into that part of human nature. It sounds a bit like sort of mad to speak about it in that way, but there's this magical end as well as the depressive sides, which are just really confusing, because sometimes it feels like two personalities. When even with things like, I saw that you're also a runner, when I'm in a good mood, that's my favorite thing, and I'm like, wow, this is Rosie loves running. And then 24 hours later, if I slip into a low and I can't think of anything worse and my body's really slow and it feels like I'm pushing against something which doesn't want to do it. The one thing I sort of still find quite confusing about bipolar is that you have those two opinions of everything within such a short amount of time.
Mentioned then running, and I know that running and music are two things that I suppose are passions for you and things that maybe you have, I don't know, won't put words in your mouth, but maybe have helped, maybe that you would lean on at times, would you say?
Yes.
Yeah. So what is it about? So is it just running or is it exercise in particular? And how has having a physical movement, how has that helped?
I think there's something about running for me where I get into a flow. So I actually really struggle with short distance running. Like a 5K for me is not an enjoyable run.
Okay.
It's half an hour and my body takes quite a long time to warm up, and I'm on quite sedative medication. Mm-hmm. So when I first got back into running after my diagnosis, I was like, oh God, I know I have to do this, but it's not coming naturally. Whereas for me, once I go past that 45 minute, an hour mark, I just become like a child with it. And I just find it so soothing, and you sort of feel those endorphins and you're enjoying yourself while on the run rather than after it. So that's sort of where I've turned to music to help, because whether I've got too much energy on a high end or if I'm struggling with energy on a low end, as soon as I get past that point of warm up, it just starts, the benefits help so much and my day's sort of turned around. And then with the music, I think, I don't know if you find this, but sometimes when you're with a mood, instead of fighting it, it's quite good to sort of feel it.
Yes.
And sometimes I love classical music and I love calming music, or if it's up tempo on a run and I just want to listen to something like club like, I always seem to be able to find music which matches my emotions, and it does make me feel sort of less alone knowing that the community listening to that song have gone to that song for a similar reason. So
yeah,
I've just found music fascinating since I was younger, I guess.
Yeah, I love music too, and I hadn't thought about it in that way, but I've definitely described a similar thing around music shifts my state. Mm-hmm. And I think that if, for example, like you said, sometimes you want to stay in the feeling, so you might play music that, yeah, kind of exacerbates the feeling, I suppose, that you have. But also, I think it, for me anyway, it can be a way to shift state. So for example, if I basically, I'm someone who I think I operate a lot at kind of a high energy, you know, up, like upregulated, like always thinking and doing and acting and quick, which obviously isn't sustainable, and it isn't something that you always want to be in that state. And I think over the last few years, I've definitely learned a lot about this and thought, okay, how can I downregulate my nervous system? How can I be more, you know, not necessarily calm and chill and zen, because that is not me, like I'm just, you know, it's just not my natural state. But for rest, for recovery, both physically and emotionally, we need that. So that's where I think music has definitely helped. I have this app called Maya app. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
No.
But it uses like binaural beats and different kinds of like brain waves within music. So there'll be some kind of, yeah, really uplifting kind of sounds, like, you know, the tracks are really long. They're like 60 minutes or 90 minutes. There's some really uplifting stuff, but there's also some like down, I don't want to say the wrong thing, but I feel like it's like gamma wave or alpha. And it basically is to downregulate your nervous system. And that was one of the first like times I think that I really was able to connect those dots between the physical and emotional state and go, I want to shift my state. And I could actually see, because I'd be wearing a health wearable, I'd actually see my heart rate come down, my heart rate variability improve, basically showing me that my body was going from a state of fight or flight into like the rest and digest system. And so it was really powerful for me to actually see it, because I think, again, when we talked before around how we feel and then seeing a physical manifestation, I think it's so hard for us to, yeah, accept almost that the mind, and, you know, kind of see the kind of, you know, we can see our bodies, right? We can see if we've got I don't know, a rash, or we can see if we, you can see our bodies, but I think because we can't see the mind, for me, seeing the, even just the data of my heart rate saying, oh, look, actually you've gone from this state to this state and it matches the way I feel, has been really, really powerful for me.
Oh, I have to try that.
Yeah. And I think, and the movement piece as well, I think a lot of people will know, yes, I'm a runner. And again, you described, you know, when you have that feeling of pushing through and elation, but do you ever find movement as on the other end as well? So for example, to bring your body down, do you do anything that's a bit more?
I love yoga.
Yeah.
On the other end. Yeah. I remember like when I first discovered it, I can get really obsessed with things, and I'd never really got the yoga bug. And then now I always come back to yoga every few months, like it comes in waves, whereas the running's more regular. But for me, if I'm going through a bad patch, setting my alarm and booking myself into a yoga early in the morning, I've sort of started, you know, with a habit, you have to connect it to something you already do. I found with that, it was like the connection to how good I feel when I'm up early, which is quite against my disposition on medication. It's really tough. So setting that alarm for 7, being there by 8 and being up before work, having done all of that, yoga for me is just so linked to that sort of early start and stretch, I guess. Yeah. So I find it very, very therapeutic, and I love hot yoga. Right. I think in the winter it's just like knowing that you're getting into like a bath or something to start the day, and I just try and be really present there, and just that no music, like sound of someone's voice who's really good at what they do. Yeah, I've definitely found my favorite teachers, and I just swear by it. If you're going through a sort of anxious stage or something, just not spending hours in bed in the morning, not doing anything, but just getting up and out of your house, that's when I get into it.
Right.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about your morning at the end. But before that, Rosie, how can people become better supporters? So it's, you know, people, like you said before, they might not think they know someone who has bipolar disorder or even another mental health disorder, like if they're suffering from depression or a really debilitating anxiety or panic disorder. How can friends, partners, parents, how can we be better supporters of those people in our lives?
I think the thing I find most helpful is I never expect my friends or family to really understand what it feels like to have bipolar, and sometimes I can understand how confusing it must be if I've cancelled on something one day and then they see me 2 days later in a great mood. But I do find really helpful is just when friends check in, like very specifically about how's your mood been or how are you feeling? Because I think whether it's someone with bipolar or whether it's a friend who you don't know what they're dealing with mentally, it is just knowing someone's thinking about you in that way is so reassuring. And I think a lot of the time bipolar comes with a lot of loneliness because you know that statistically none of your friends have it. Mm. So even just someone putting out an olive branch and checking in is so great. And then sometimes that will lead to a conversation where they'll say what they're dealing with, and you just realize that everyone's got their thing and it doesn't have to be the same to know that the things which help. The other thing I'd probably say is never sort of, and I've never had a friend do this, but I know that it would maybe hurt, is if someone suggests that I'm high or low.
Right.
I think it's good to not assume, because in those high states, sometimes it is just a natural high as well. It's not always a bipolar high, and it's not going to escalate. And I think in the past, it's just been one of those things where you also want to feel normal and feel that you can turn up in an elated mood and not everyone not think that it's part of your illness.
Yeah.
So I've never had that, but I know that it would probably make me feel quite self-conscious if someone said, hey, you high. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, because I've got friends who make me feel really safe, I will always tell them if I'm high, and I hope that they would know that.
Because it's complex, isn't it, to navigate, as you said, for someone else. They might not fully understand, you know, but they have to, I suppose, just accept that. And like you said, your expectation isn't that they're going to say to you, oh, I really know how you feel, I really know what you're going through, because they don't, you know, they don't. And I think that's something that people are sometimes afraid to say. You know, I had a friend recently who lost a parent, and you know, I didn't say to her like, oh, I know how you feel, because I don't know how she feels, that grief, that, you know, she was had such intense grief, and I just said, you know, this is so terrible and awful, and I'm just going to be here for you as your friend, but I can't relate to you, I can't say to you, you know, oh, this is how, you know, I think what I think you should do or how you should feel, because I don't know. And I think sometimes people are afraid to say that, to go, you know what, Rosie, I have no idea what it feels like to experience what you're going through, but you know what, I'm here, I'm your friend, and it's cool, you know?
Yeah, it's so nice as well, because I think when a friend listens for you, it's always a two-way street. And it's nice because then when you listen to them, you feel like you're not this burden with your bipolar, you're just being a friend. And I always never wanted it to feel a thing which made me out of balance with also supporting my friends for their mental health, and I've really managed to do that by the way that my friends have been with me, for sure.
What about parents? Because I was thinking, you know, I have my son's nearly a teenager now, which is kind of wild. I'm just like, oh my gosh, he's nearly a teenager. And I know that, you know, a lot of his friends have got older siblings. And so I feel like some of my friends, parents going into that stage of adolescence, and, you know, you said you were young when you got your diagnosis. So how did your parents support you? What advice would you give to any parents if, you know, their children have mental illness and mental health or neurodiversity and they're kind of going through that diagnosis process with them?
It was such a small thing, but I remember when you're quite young and your friends maybe aren't speaking about mental illness at school or symptoms or anything, it was such a small thing, but my mum coming with me to the doctors, I don't think that ever gets old. Like, if she offered to come with me now, I'd be thrilled.
Right.
I just think those appointments, I'm 28 now, but when I'm speaking about serious things, or I remember when I was discharged back to my GP and they said, look, when you get pregnant, remember you should really sign up for care again because you're at high risk of postnatal psychosis. And having my mum in the room, it also had that person to sort of break the illusion when we left and just have a laugh about it and just have someone who's heard the conversations I'm having who can come out and be like, Rosie, they're just, they do have to say these things as well. Yeah. The likelihood is that you might, you know, not, that might not happen to you. So I think just having someone in the room, a parent, is always a safe bet, because you're not, they know, or they've seen you in your lows and they've seen you in your highs. Whereas a friend or a partner, that can put quite a lot of strain on the relationship. And like I said, maybe would make me feel a bit out of balance with that person. Mm. So yes, I think you're never too old to have a parent with you in those conversations, which are quite daunting sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about the power hour. We touched on it already about how, you know, I'm sure every day is different, but when we wake up in the morning, I'm always fascinated to find out from people, what is it really that drives them to get them out of bed? You know, what things do people enjoy in the morning? What things do people include? What do people avoid in the first hour of every day? So Rosie, typically right now, could you tell us what time you wake up in the morning and what does the first hour of your day look like?
I'm going to be very bipolar about this. I have two types of morning.
Right.
Completely. And it's not what you would think, that one's low or one's high. It's nothing like that. It's just that, so I take a medication called quetiapine, which is also really good for insomnia and anyone who has sleep issues, but it does completely make you out of it for the first half of your day. So at first I'd sort of struggle with that, and always set an alarm at 7 and try and get up and try and exercise and try and make every day perfect. Whereas now I stagger it every other day.
Okay.
So my Mondays, my Wednesdays and my Fridays, I wake up with 15 minutes to leave the house and I have a quick shower. I'll dry my hair so I feel good about myself. And I always try and choose something which makes me feel nice, even if I'm not seeing anyone at work. Whereas my Tuesdays and my Thursdays and my weekend days, I will make sure that I have so much time in the morning. It will be my alarm, and then I'll put on a filter coffee in the kitchen. I'll turn on Gold FM, which is my favourite radio ever. It's like all 70s music, and I'm just obsessed with it. And in that time, I'll have my coffee. At the moment, I'm writing a book, and that first sort of half an hour of my day, that's when I'm best at writing. Well, I think at the time I'm good at writing. Sometimes I look back later in the day and I'm like, maybe I was still quite sleepy, but I'll do that then and then do my run after those coffees. Mm. Usually I'll have like that pot will make about 2, and it's such a silly thing, and I know that everyone has this, but I love the taste of coffee so much.
Yeah.
And I only discovered it maybe 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And for me, that first hour of just writing a bit, I just do anything but check my phone, basically.
Yep.
That's always what I try and do on the overground on the way to work. But it's just sort of a sacred moment. And yeah, whether it's a run or whether it's yoga, that's my ideal morning. I just stagger it so that I have that wave of sort of nervousness at my alarm and anticipation a bit. And that can be 50-50 in a week. I don't think for me it takes 2 weeks of not exercising to want to do it.
Right.
It's just respecting that extra bit of sleep some days.
You know what, I think a lot of listeners and a lot of people that I know would really enjoy that alternating thing, regardless that, you know, bipolar or not, they're kind of the idea that actually, okay, one day I'm going to get up and do the thing and the next day I'm going to take it easy, because I think in life we need contrast, right? And I think the idea of consistency, you know, I've kind of changed my mind on this word consistency. Now, we're all allowed to, you know, learn and evolve and change our minds. And I'm sure, you know, if someone went back 5 years and listened to the first episodes of this show, or I don't know, found an article that I'd written or something, I'm sure somewhere it probably exists, me saying that consistency is the key and consistency is great and consistency is important. And I think to some certain projects maybe, but I think on the whole consistency in life is unachievable. I don't think we're consistent as human beings. We are inconsistent, and our lives are inconsistent, and the world's inconsistent. And so I really like that idea actually of alternating and saying, okay, you still have structure and a plan, so it's not just an ad hoc, like, oh, do I feel like getting up today or do I feel like not? But I think having an alternating thing, I've said to people before about the power hour, I said, if you don't want to do it every single day, maybe start with one day every week. So you can start with a Wednesday and be like, every Wednesday, I'm going to have my power hour, and maybe that's exercise or maybe that's writing, but it doesn't feel that pressure every day to be like, I have to consistently sometimes force myself to you know, be the same version of myself every single day, because we can't be.
I would also, yeah, I used to be a morning person, which is where, and my sisters are like this, before I was on medication, I was up at 5 every day. I did my run by 6. I would be well awake before anyone else in the house. And then with sort of respecting now that my body feels a bit slower and having those like 3 mornings a week where I sleep right up until my alarm, it's just made me so grateful when I do my early mornings that it's like still a novelty. Like on a Tuesday, my friend Sarah and I often pick her up at 6:45 in the morning, drive to the Heath, do a run and get a coffee all while the sun is rising. And I think if I did that more than once a week, it would take away from like that feeling after where I'm like, I should do this every day. And then I'm like, well, actually, I won't do it every day, because if I do, then next Tuesday won't feel like this.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's just, yeah, picking my days where I have these sort of rituals, that Tuesday or the weekend where it's really slow and it's sort of like breakfast in bed. I have a routine in a week by week sort of structure.
Yeah, it sounds good. And I've really enjoyed having this conversation with you, Rosie. Oh, I knew that we would, so yeah, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing with myself and all the listeners as well.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks everyone for tuning in. As always, I will be back next Tuesday with another episode. See ya.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.